UDEM Research, Kindergarten from First Principles, Episode 2. Welcome back to The Deep Dive.
Today, we're tackling a big one. It's one of the most beloved and, frankly, one of the most misunderstood topics in all of developmental science.
Play as pedagogy.
Exactly. Specifically, how play really impacts the learning and development of children, let's say, between the ages of 4 and 6.
Right. And if you spend any time on educational blogs or, you know, reading parenting guides, the whole conversation about play can feel almost religious.
It's treated with a certain reverence, for sure. A lot of enthusiasm.
A ton of enthusiasm, but maybe not always a lot of hard scientific interrogation. We all know play is important. That's sort of the baseline. But our mission today is to move past the cheerleading.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to dive deep into the source material. We're talking neurobiology, large-scale randomized trials, the big meta-analyses, all to extract the critical nuance.
So we're not asking if play matters. That's a given.
No. We're asking how it matters. And crucially, what does the evidence actually prove versus what we just sort of assume it proves?
And when you start that interrogation, you immediately run into the central paradox of play research. This is really going to be the structural backbone of our entire deep dive today.
Okay, what's the paradox?
Well, on one hand, the evidence that play literally shapes and optimizes the architecture of the brain is incredibly strong. It's rooted in these precise, measurable neurobiological mechanisms.
So the how at the brain level is pretty clear.
Very clear. But on the other hand, when you look at the behavioral data, the measurable lasting cognitive gains, the tangible academic outcomes, the empirical effect sizes are often, well, surprisingly modest.
So strong mechanisms, but modest measurable effects. That's the tension.
That's the tension. And it's what makes this topic so intellectually rigorous. It forces us to confront this key theoretical concept that really defines the whole scientific argument. Equifinality.
Equifinality. Let's define that.
It forces us to ask, is play the uniquely necessary route to a positive developmental outcome? Or is it just one of many valid routes that all lead to the same destination?
Got it. Is it the only road or one of several roads to Rome?
A perfect analogy. Now, before we really get into that debate, we have to establish a clear vocabulary. We'll be talking a lot about cognitive change and effect sizes.
Right.
The primary area that researchers track when they're looking at early childhood development is something called executive function, or EF.
Okay, let's make sure we define EF robustly here. Because it's not just IQ and it's not just memory.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Think of it as the set of high-level cognitive processes you need for any kind of goal-directed behavior, for planning, for self-control.
The brain's CEO, basically.
That's a great way to put it. And we usually break it down into three core components. First, you have working memory. That's your ability to hold and manipulate information in your mind, like remembering a multi-step instruction from a teacher.
Okay.
Then you have inhibitory control. This is probably the most famous one. It's just your ability to resist impulsive actions or ignore distracting things around you.
The don't eat the marshmallow skill.
The classic example. And finally, you've got cognitive flexibility. This is your ability to shift attention or switch between different tasks or rules quickly. You know, like changing your role in the middle of a pretend play game.
Those skills are enormous predictors of success, not just in school, but way into adulthood. So when we try to quantify how much a play intervention helps these skills, we use a statistic, right?
We do. We use what's called an effect size, and you'll see it denoted as the letter G.
Okay, G.
Effect size just tells us the magnitude of the difference between a group that gets the play intervention and a control group that doesn't. And when researchers do these big meta-analyses, which are studies that combine the results of dozens of individual trials.
So they're getting a bird's eye view of the entire field.
Exactly. They consistently find a small to moderate effect size for these play-based EF interventions.
And what does that number actually look like?
It tends to cluster in the range of, let's say, G equals about 0.3 to 0.4. To be specific, one big 2020 meta-analysis established the overall effect for play-based interventions right at G equals 0.352.
So let's put that in context for everyone. What does G equals 0.352 actually mean?
Well, in educational research, a small effect is often around 0.2.
Mm.
A moderate effect is 0.5. And anything like 0.8 or higher is considered a really strong transformative intervention.
So 0.352 means the benefit is absolutely real. It's statistically significant.
Yeah.
But It's modest.
It's modest. It is a valuable contributing factor, but it's not a silver bullet. It's not going to replace the need for all these other educational components.
And that number, that G equals 0.352, that's the scientific reality we have to keep anchoring ourselves to, especially when all the rhetoric around us is just so enthusiastic.
That's our ground truth.
Okay, so let's start where you said the evidence is most compelling, the neurobiological level. Mm-hmm. Let's unpack how play is literally rewiring a developing brain.
Right. This is where the research is just, it's beautiful. Really, it shows that play isn't just a nice activity to pass the time. It is a fundamental process that is shaping our physical development.
Our physical brain.
Our physical brain. Precisely. Play, especially the highly engaged social kind of play, is not a passive activity. It's metabolically demanding. It engages a deeply coordinated, very specialized neural network. You can almost think of it as a master regulator for our developmental systems.
So which specific regions of the brain are doing the heavy lifting in this network?
We're talking about a pretty sophisticated functional integration here. The network involves the prefrontal cortex, or PFC.
The seat of executive function we just talked about.
The very same. Then you have the dorsal and ventral striatum, which manages things like motor control, habit formation, and reward processing. And finally, the amygdala, which is absolutely critical for emotional appraisal and, you know, that quick regulation of feelings.
Can you walk us through a real-time example? How does this network fire in, say, a four-year-old?
Okay, sure. Imagine two kids in a complex game of tag. They got these arbitrary, agreed-upon rules like, you can only tag someone if you're standing on one foot.
Okay, I'm with you.
So one child gets tagged out. They feel an immediate spike of frustration or disappointment.
Yeah.
That's mediated by the amygdala. Their impulse might be to stomp their foot and scream.
A very four-year-old impulse.
A very four-year-old impulse. But instead, they pause. They apply inhibitory control, that's a PFC function, to resist that impulse. They hold the one-foot rule in their working memory, and they decide to calmly rejoin the next round. The striatum then facilitates that adjusted, more appropriate behavior.
Oh, wow. So that single moment of self-regulation is the whole network training and high-speed integration. Play is basically high-intensity interval training for the prefrontal cortex.
That is a fantastic way to describe it. It is. Play forces these systems, emotion, reward, cognition, to sync up and adjust rapidly. It's optimizing the complex pathways that you need for advanced self-regulation.
And this isn't just a human thing, right? This is deeper.
Oh, much deeper. This is where Jack Panksepp's foundational work is so important. He established play as one of seven primary emotional systems that are hardwired into all mammalian brains.
That evolutionary perspective is crucial. It tells you this isn't some cultural invention.
Exactly. Panksepp's research, a lot of it was done on laboratory rats, showed that even rats whose cortex was surgically removed.
So they lacked the parts for higher level thought.
Right. Even they still engaged in the behaviors we recognize as play, totally normally. The neural generators for play are deep down in the subcortical regions. This shows us that play is fundamental. It's a biological drive, as primary as seeking food or sex.
But right here, we hit our first major counterintuitive finding, one that really challenges the common assumption that more complexity is always better. This is the fascinating research from the University of Lethbridge.
Yes, from Pellis and Kolb. Their finding was genuinely surprising. I mean, you would expect that juvenile rats who get ample peer play, this enriched environment, would show a bigger, denser, more interconnected brain structure compared to the play-deprived animal.
That would be my assumption. More stimulation, more brain growth.
But that is not what they saw. In fact, they observed decreased dendritic complexity in the medial prefrontal cortex of the rats that had a lot of play experience.
Decreased complexity, that sounds like a bad thing. It sounds like play was somehow harming connectivity.
It does, doesn't it? But the interpretation completely flips that assumption on its head. Decreased complexity here is actually evidence of more efficient synaptic pruning.
Pruning. Okay, explain that.
So think of the developing brain like a brand new city's telephone network. At first, it just throws wires absolutely everywhere, making all sorts of redundant connections.
Total chaos.
Total chaos. And then throughout childhood, we naturally lose about 40% of our neural connections through this process called pruning. Play experience acts like an expert editor or an optimization algorithm. It helps the brain determine which connections to preserve and strengthen because they're useful and which ones to eliminate because they're redundant or inefficient.
So the brain isn't just getting bigger. It's getting smarter. It's getting faster. It's learning to focus its resources based on experience.
More efficient. It's getting more efficient.
Right, more efficient.
That is the critical implication. The work from Bell and others in 2010 really proposed that adequate play creates a more adaptable, more streamlined brain, one that is highly responsive to new challenges and later learning experiences, rather than just a structurally bigger or denser one.
And this structural efficiency, it's tied directly to the molecular level, right?
Right.
How does physical rough and tumble play actually communicate this need for optimization down to the neurons?
Through neurotrophic factors. Vigorous, often physical play actually increases the expression of key growth factors in the brain. Two of the major ones are BDNF, which is brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and IGF-1, which is insulin-like growth factor 1.
They almost sound like muscle-building compounds, but for building brain structure.
That's a great way to think about it. And the research is specific. A 2003 study by Gordon and others showed that BDNF elevates specifically in the amygdala and the frontal cortex after just 30 minutes of play. IGF-1 also gets upregulated in the frontal and posterior cortices. These are real physical signals.
And what's their actual function in the brain? What do they do?
They are molecular mediators. They support synapse formation, they protect the existing neuronal structures, and they facilitate neuronal survival. They essentially act as fertilizer for the brain. They promote the growth and maintenance of the connections that are being used and refined by the play activity.
So that gives us the direct physiological link. The physical engagement of running or wrestling or even intense pretend play translates into structural neuroplasticity in the exact brain regions responsible for executive control.
It's the mechanism. And this entire process is driven by the inherent desire to play, which is itself physiologically rewarded by what we call the dopaminergic reward loop.
The joy of play is a survival mechanism.
It is. Dopamine increases in a brain area called the nucleus accumbens. That creates the high that drives the motivation to seek out playmates and sustain that social interaction. At the same time, opioid release enhances the play's reward value. This whole cocktail creates the optimal cognitive and emotional state.
So the child is not only motivated to play, but they're also physiologically primed. They're focused, attentive, and intrinsically engaged to absorb the lessons embedded in the activity.
It creates the perfect state for learning, but without the external stress that comes with formalized instruction.
Now, animal models give us incredible precision, but we have to see this in humans. And as you said, getting a four-year-old to lie perfectly still inside a giant noisy fMRI machine is, well, it's pretty much impossible.
It's a logistical nightmare, but that's where technology has really stepped in. A 2020 study from Hashmi and their team used something called near-infrared spectroscopy, or FNIRS. It's a wearable, much less invasive system that can measure blood flow changes in the cortex during natural movement. They studied 33 kids between 4 and 8 years old during different play scenarios.
And what did this human neuroimaging actually reveal about something like symbolic play?
They found significant activation in the posterior superior temporal sulcus, or PSTS. This is a key region in the brain for social processing, for theory of mind, for identifying intentions. And it was activated even when children were engaged in highly symbolic pretend play completely alone.
Alone, with dolls or blocks.
I agree.
That's a huge finding.
It is. It suggests that symbolic, solitary play isn't just imaginative fluff. The child is literally running simulations. They're practicing social cognitive skills, perspective taking, emotional interaction, all without needing a real peer present. It's a neurological sandbox for developing social intelligence.
A training ground for real-world interactions.
A crucial one. And they also confirmed that joint play, playing with someone else, demanded even more resources. They saw greater activation in the right prefrontal cortex during collaborative activities compared to solo play. So the social context really adds another layer of cognitive complexity.
Okay, so the neurobiological case is established. It's clear. Play builds and optimizes the brain's structures for regulation and for thinking. But, and this is a big but, this beautiful neurobiology only really matters if it translates into persistent, measurable, real-world outcomes.
And that is where the behavioral studies introduce that sobering dose of reality we mentioned at the start.
Right. Let's look at the measurable cognitive gains focusing on executive function.
This is where we need to hold that initial figure firmly in our minds. The overall effect size for play-based EF interventions sits at a modest G equals 0.352. That's the average performance across many studies and thousands of children.
Real, but modest. And the research gets even more challenging when we start to look at things like transferability and persistence.
Exactly. I mean, it's not enough to show that a child got better at a specific game they were taught. They need to show that it got better at untaught, unrelated cognitive tasks months later.
The skill needs to generalize.
it has to generalize. And the most sobering analysis on this front comes from a 2019 review by Talkbacks and Kasai. They synthesized data from 90 different studies involving almost 9,000 children, and they broke down the effects by how similar the measured outcome was to the training activity.
Okay, so what did they find about near versus far transfer?
Near transfer effects, so where the measurement task was very closely related to the play intervention, for example, training inhibitory control in a game and then testing it with a similar rule-following task, those were statistically significant. They found an effect size of G equals 0.44. That's a moderate, pretty good gain.
Okay, so that works, but what about far transfer?
That's where it fell apart. Far transfer effects, so benefits that transfer to completely untrained distal domains like standardized math or reading comprehension, were deemed not significant. The effect size clustered way down around G equals 0.11.
Wow. So the kids are getting good at the specific game, but that skill isn't reliably translating into a persistent, generalized improvement in their overall intellectual toolkit.
That's the challenge.
Yeah.
And the theory behind this points to metacognition, to self-monitoring.
Yeah.
Most EF training through play improves the ability to perform a specific task, but it doesn't always build the awareness or the will to strategically apply that skill in a brand new context.
So the kid doesn't think to themselves, oh, this math test is hard. I should use that inhibitory control strategy I learned during the block game.
Precisely.
Yeah.
That metacognitive link is often missing. Mm. And the persistence problem just compounds this.
Right.
The starkest finding from that Talkbacks and Kasai analysis was the lack of durability. They concluded, and this is a direct quote, there was no convincing evidence for benefits to remain on follow-up assessment.
So the benefits fade.
They fade. And if the benefit disappears within a few months, it severely limits the claim that these play-based curricula are providing some kind of long-term foundational cognitive restructuring.
This whole challenge, this difficulty in scaling up and replicating benefits, is perfectly illustrated by the rise and the subsequent controversy around the Tools of the Mind curriculum.
Oh, absolutely. Tools of the Mind is this classic example. It's based heavily on Vygotskian principles. It emphasizes sophisticated, self-regulated, dramatic play. It often involves children writing out little scripts for their play scenarios.
And the initial studies were incredibly promising.
They were fantastic. Small sample studies by researchers like Adele Diamond back in 2007 showed huge, significant EF benefits. The hope was immense. It really seemed like the perfect proof. You structure play in this specific way, you get massive cognitive gains.
But then they tried to scale it. They tried to roll it out into real-world school systems.
And that's where the replication challenge hit like a brick wall. First, a 2014 study by Blair and Raver looked at 715 children in high-poverty schools. They found only modest benefits, mostly in vocabulary and early math, but not that widespread EF transformation that everyone was hoping for.
Still some benefit.
Some benefit. But then came the definitive test. The largest randomized controlled trial, or RCT, conducted under the Head Start Cares Initiative in 2014.
And this was a massive undertaking. How big was the sample?
It involved 2,016 children across 155 different Head Start centers. It was designed specifically to test the effectiveness of this Vygotskian play-based intervention in a real-world, large-scale environment.
And the finding?
The finding was devastating for proponents of the curriculum. The intervention group showed no statistically significant EF differences when compared to the control group.
No difference in over 2,000 children. That really challenges the core assumption that the Vygotskian theory, when you package it into a curriculum, is some kind of magic bullet.
It does. It implies that the magic doesn't lie in the curriculum name or the theory alone. It probably lies in the highly skilled, low-ratio implementation that you find in those initial small studies.
So it's about the teacher, not just the playbook.
It suggests that these highly nuanced, teacher-dependent interventions, where the teacher has to subtly scaffold play without ever directing it, are just fundamentally difficult, maybe even impossible, to standardize across a mass population with varied teacher training and resources.
The failure to replicate really forces a kind of intellectual modesty.
It has to. And that modesty is exactly what Angeline Lillard called for in her really influential 2013 review, where she questioned the core causal claims of the entire field. She brought us right back to that equifinality debate.
Right, the many roads to Rome problem.
Her review forces researchers to be precise about what they're actually claiming. Lillard defined these three critical interpretations for the data. First, there's crucial causality.
Okay.
That's the idea that play, and often a specific kind of play like pretend play, is uniquely necessary for a specific developmental milestone, like symbolic reasoning or problem solving.
Then what's the second interpretation?
The second is equifinality. This is the idea that play is simply one of multiple equally valid routes to the same outcome. So a child could develop inhibitory control through play or through martial arts or through structured music lessons.
And the third?
The third is epiphenomenalism. This is the most skeptical view. It suggests that play is merely a marker of development, not the cause. So both sophisticated play and high EF might stem from some third underlying factor, like high parental investment or a genetic predisposition.
So based on her synthesis of over 150 studies, where did Lillard land on this?
She concluded that the evidence provides strong support for equifinality or epiphenomenalism, but not for crucial causality. She found, for instance, no compelling evidence that pretend play helps or is even a correlate for domain-general problem solving.
So this doesn't mean play isn't valuable.
No, not at all. It just means we can't scientifically isolate it as the sole cause that must be universally mandated to achieve these specific cognitive outcomes.
But let's balance that skepticism with an area where the longitudinal data is robust and highly compelling. And that's the association between early symbolic representations, spatial reasoning, and later mathematics.
Yes, this correlation is one of the most consistent findings in the entire literature. Symbolic play. That ability to use one object to mentally represent another, you know, using a block as a cell phone or a stick as a spoon, that's a foundational skill for abstract reasoning. It's the bridge from the concrete world to the cognitive world.
And the data from block play is astonishingly persistent over time.
It truly is. There are studies that track the complexity of children's block play in preschool, how complex their structures were, their use of balancing, their spatial vocabulary. And they found that this early measure showed significant positive relationships with, get this, seventh grade mathematical test scores.
Seventh grade, that's a decade later.
And not just test scores. Also, later high school math grades, including enrollment in honors courses. And this was even when controlling for the child's initial IQ.
That is a staggering transfer over time. How do we explain a preschool activity with blocks showing up in high school math performance?
Well, the theory is that block play provides this critical, hands-on practice in spatial visualization. In mentally manipulating objects in three dimensions, these are the very same cognitive skills, mental rotation, visualization, that underpin complex mathematics and engineering. The early symbolic manipulation provides a physical anchor for later, much more abstract geometric and algebraic thought.
Okay, let's zoom out one last time to the biggest, longest-running piece of evidence we have for play-based active learning education, the Perry Preschool Study.
This is a classic.
Yeah.
Conducted in Ypsilanti, Michigan back in the 1960s, it was a true randomized trial involving 123 low-income African-American children. They received a high-scope curriculum, which is a play-based active learning model. And this is key. It was combined with intensive home visits.
And the results, when they followed up with these kids at age 40, were world-changing.
They were just stunning. The children from the intervention group had significantly higher high school graduation rates, higher employment, higher median earnings, fewer arrests, and much lower welfare dependency compared to the control group.
An incredible social and financial return.
The economic analysis, which was led by the Nobel laureate James Heckman, concluded that the investment yielded a staggering 7 to 10% annual rate of return. That far exceeds what you typically get from equity markets over that same period.
But the nuance here, again, is so critical for understanding the role of play by itself.
Absolutely. The nuance is that the initial IQ gains they saw in the children faded relatively quickly. By age 8, they were gone.
So it wasn't an IQ bump?
No. The durable, lifelong effects weren't based on an IQ bump. They were derived from non-cognitive skills, things like persistence, motivation, impulse control, and self-regulation. And maybe most importantly, the intervention was comprehensive. It wasn't just the play curriculum in the classroom. It was that intensive home visiting component, which actively engaged parents and reinforced the lessons being learned at school.
So the lesson of Perry is that high-quality play-based learning is most potent when it's part of a whole system. One that targets non-cognitive skills and embeds that learning within the child's entire ecosystem, including the home.
It wasn't just play. It was play plus context and continuity.
Okay, so if pure, unstructured free play doesn't always guarantee these specific cognitive gains, and the attempt to scale a highly prescriptive curriculum like Tools of the Mind failed to show far transfer, where is the sweet spot?
This is what researchers are now calling the Goldilocks solution.
Yeah.
We need an approach that preserves the joy and the intrinsic motivation of play, but avoids the inefficiency of entirely undirected activity.
And the solution emerging from the most recent large-scale analyses is guided play.
Exactly. This approach retains child autonomy, which is critical, but it introduces this subtle, intentional adult scaffolding to help meet specific learning objectives.
How do researchers actually operationalize that? I mean, the line between guiding and just plain directing can feel very thin.
It can. Hirsch-Pesek and Golenkopf define it in two crucial ways. First, the adult sets up the environment. They design the stage, so to speak. They might highlight learning goals, like arranging shapes or counting materials, but they ensure the child maintains autonomy and choice within that environment.
So the adult curates the space.
Right. And second, the adult joins the play and asks questions or makes gentle suggestions that might redirect the child toward that learning objective, but without ever taking control. The adult acts as a supportive co-player, not an instructor.
So does this method actually outperform the extremes? Free play on one side, direct instruction on the other?
Unequivocally, yes. The definitive meta-analysis on this was by Skeen and their team in 2022. It synthesized 39 studies, almost 4,000 children, and it showed a clear superiority for guided play across a whole host of domains.
Let's get into the numbers.
Okay, so when you compare guided play versus direct instruction, guided play showed significant benefits for targeted outcomes, things like shape knowledge, where the effect size was G equals 0.63.
Okay, 0.63 is starting to get pretty substantial.
It is. It's nearing that large transformative effect size. It also helped with task switching at G equals 0.40 and early math skills at 0.24.
That's fascinating. It suggests that even for something as simple as learning shapes, a child who discovers and internalizes the concept through guided exploration learns it more deeply than one who's just lectured at.
But the comparison to pure free play was even more striking, particularly in language development. For spatial vocabulary, we're talking words like above, below, adjacent, underneath. The effect size favoring guided play was massive. It was G equals 0.93.
Wait, 0.93? That's almost a full standard deviation. That is a huge persistent difference. Why that specific skill?
Because children who are playing freely might perform the action, right? They'll put the block on top of the tower. But without an adult gently joining in and labeling that action with rich language, the children miss the chance to map their physical action onto these sophisticated linguistic concepts.
The adult acts as a bridge.
A bridge between the physical action and the abstract spatial language, which, as we saw earlier, feeds directly into later mathematical reasoning.
This really reinforces the need for what you might call functional specialization. We need both types of play because they seem to optimize for different kinds of learning.
Precisely. Unstructured, free play is superior for maximizing exploration, creativity, and broad causal discovery. It's about building agency, testing limits. Structured or guided play, on the other hand, is better for targeted skill mastery. Things like specific executive functions or concrete academic skills like numerosity.
And there's a fantastic example of the cost of over-directing, isn't there?
Yes. Studies show that if an adult directly instructs a child on how a new toy works, say they show them just one mechanism, the child is demonstrably less likely to explore and discover the other latent attributes or hidden functions of that toy.
They stop exploring once they get the correct answer from the authority figure.
Right. The child switches from being an exploratory scientist to being a compliance-driven student. Guided play manages that tension. It keeps the curiosity loop open while subtly nudging the child toward the intended learning goal. The optimal strategy is an integration of both.
Now, beyond cognitive gains, play is the primary laboratory for social-emotional development, the peer laboratory. This is where skills like perspective-taking, negotiation, conflict resolution, this is where they're forged.
And this is where the autonomy and free play becomes absolutely non-negotiable. Sociodramatic play forces children to autonomously negotiate everything. The roles, the rules, the narrative, and how to handle the inevitable conflicts that come up.
And we have a really striking finding about the role of adults in this negotiation process. This is a true counterintuitive policy paradox.
It is. A study observed 5-year-olds during recess, tracking their social interactions and then their later school achievement. The findings show that the level of social interaction with peers during recess predicted subsequent school achievement positively.
Okay, that makes sense.
But, and this is the key finding, the level of social interaction with teachers during recess was negatively related to school achievement.
Wait a minute. So the supportive, caring adult who is trying to help manage a dispute or encourage a shy child is, on average, negatively correlated with that child's eventual academic success. That just defies all of our policy instincts.
The interpretation is profound. The greatest social and regulatory gains happen when children are forced to negotiate independently. When an adult steps in to solve the conflict or mediate the negotiation, they provide an external solution.
And that circumvents the necessary practice.
It circumvents the difficult practice the child needs to develop their own internal locus of control, their own emotional regulation, their own self-efficacy for solving problems. Adult intervention, even when it's well-intended, can short-circuit that critical learning loop.
That puts immense pressure on schools to protect unsupervised, free playtime, where kids can fail and resolve conflict without an authority figure stepping in.
It does. The goal should be to create the conditions for autonomous social negotiation.
And there's even a fascinating data point about the power of just watching, passive observation.
Yes. A study looking at adaptive skills in preschoolers found that while active physical play was certainly correlated with positive social skills, when all the predictors were put into a statistical regression model, the only factor that remained uniquely significant was watching other children play.
Just watching, not even actively participating. What does that suggest about social learning?
It suggests that silent observation and peer modeling are an indispensable and perhaps really undervalued part of the learning process. The child who's standing on the periphery isn't disengaged. They are absorbing complex social dynamics, behavioral strategies, conflict resolution techniques. It's a profound form of cognitive preparation.
Okay, so we've established the Goldilocks solution, a mix of guided play and autonomous peer interaction. Now we need to pivot to the risk. Section 4, we need to examine what happens when play is removed entirely. And this reveals a fundamental asymmetry in the research.
It does. The evidence for play's necessity is actually strongest when it is removed, in deprivation studies, than when it is added or optimized. The harm caused by deprivation appears to be clearer and larger than the measurable benefit gained from enrichment.
Let's start with the controlled animal models that really define this deprivation effect.
We can go back to juvenile rats. When they are socially play deprived during a very critical developmental period, that's postnatal days 21 through 42, the structural and behavioral consequences are measurable and long-lasting.
And what were those long-term deficits caused by just that short period of deprivation?
Well, cognitively, the deprivation caused a reduction in inhibitory synapses in the prefrontal cortex. This manifested as them using much simpler strategies for complex adult tasks. Socially, the deprived rats showed profound impairments. They couldn't reliably distinguish a familiar, non-threatening peer from a hostile new one.
Wow.
They exhibited impaired mating rituals, and they had significantly reduced stress resilience when they were placed in new environments.
So removing play during that sensitive period literally prevented the emergence of complex, flexible, adult-like behavior. Did researchers find any kind of minimum effective dose here?
They did, and this is crucial. They noted a dose-response relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Even giving the deprived rats just one daily hour of play during that deprivation period was enough to partially rescue their cognitive skills. This provides a hard physical metric for the necessity of protected playtime.
And the closest, most tragic human analog we have to this kind of controlled deprivation is the Bucharest Early Intervention Project. This involved children raised in the severely neglectful Romanian orphanages.
Right. This was a randomized trial that compared institutional care, where social interaction and play stimulation were grossly limited, to placement in high-quality foster care. And because of this setup, the researchers were able to quantify the physical costs of deprivation.
And those costs were startlingly physical.
They were. They found that each additional month, a child spent in that understimulated institutional environment was associated with a statistically significant 0.27% reduction in total brain volume.
A measurable physical loss of brain matter.
A measurable loss tied directly to the time spent without adequate play and human interaction. They saw decreased gray matter and significantly decreased glucose metabolism in crucial areas like the orbital frontal gyrus and the amygdala.
The very areas we identified at the beginning as being central to emotional regulation and social processing.
Exactly. And these children later showed high rates of attentional disorders, including ADHD symptoms that persisted all the way through age 16.
And the existence of a sensitive period for recovery, just like in the rats, that has to be a critical policy signal.
Absolutely. The research identified a sensitive window. Children who were placed in high-quality foster care before 22 months of age showed substantial recovery, including measurable EEG improvements. But placement after 22 months resulted in much more limited recovery.
Which underlines why early childhood intervention and the protection of play for at-risk children is just an urgent, non-elective necessity.
It's not a nice-to-have, it's a must-have.
This deprivation data helps us transition back to the idea of the minimum effective dose for play in typically developing children. If we need sustained engagement to trigger those neurobiological upregulations, the BDNF and IGF-1 release, how much time is actually required?
A meta-regression analysis looking at chronic, cognitively engaging physical activity in kids aged 4 to 12 provided a really concrete, actionable benchmark. They concluded that for an intervention to yield a small but significant positive effect on overall executive function, it has to include sessions that last at least 35 minutes.
35 minutes. That's a practical, evidence-based data point that schools can actually use. It confirms that short, sporadic breaks aren't enough to drive chronic neurobiological improvements.
Hey.
The time has to be sustained to trigger that molecular cascade.
It has major policy implications.
Yeah.
I mean, so many schools schedule recess in these 10 or 15-minute bursts. This research suggests that if your goal is chronic EF improvement, that timing is just inadequate.
You need sustained, protected playtime.
You have to meet the metabolic threshold.
Speaking of impact, we have to address the powerful equity implications of play-based intervention. The effect sizes we've been discussing are averages, but those averages obscure the fact that play is not equally beneficial for all children.
That is a crucial point.
Yeah.
Play-based interventions are most effective for those children who are starting with the greatest developmental or socioeconomic disadvantages.
So the overall effect size was about G equals 0.35.
Correct. But when researchers isolated the data for at-risk children, so those with existing attentional difficulties, developmental delays, or from low socioeconomic status backgrounds, the effect size jumped significantly.
How much larger was the effect for that at-risk group?
The effect size was G equals 0.785.
Wow. That's over twice the size of the average effect. That's approaching the high end of what's considered a transformative intervention.
It is, which makes play a profoundly effective tool for educational equity.
It absolutely does. It suggests that high-quality, play-based early childhood education functions as critical compensatory education. It helps make up for the variability in stimulating learning environments that children experience at home. It provides that foundational self-regulation and cognitive scaffolding they need to close the achievement gap before formal schooling even begins.
It's a massive lever for equity.
And finally, as a cautionary note, we have the correlational work, which has been popularized by Peter Gray, linking the modern decline in free, unsupervised play with the rise in mental health issues.
Gray documented that outdoor play and free roaming have declined drastically. By some estimates, a 71% decline in a single generation. And he correlates this decline with rising rates of anxiety and psychopathology, including the quadrupling of suicide rates in U.S. children under 15 between 1950 and 2005.
It's a dramatic correlation that really resonates with people, but we have to maintain scientific rigor here.
Precisely. We have to stress this is purely correlational, not causal proof. I mean, the world changed dramatically between 1950 and 2005 in terms of diet, screen time, testing pressure, parental anxiety. But the theoretical argument is sound. Play builds essential resilience, the ability to assess risk, manage fear, resolve conflicts on your own, all of which serve as crucial buffers against mental health struggles.
And the most frustrating policy failure linked to this correlation is the fate of recess itself, especially following the No Child Left Behind era.
Oh, absolutely. Post-NCLB, this assumption took hold that time spent in play was time taken away from academics. And based on that assumption, 40% of U.S. school districts either reduced or completely eliminated recess.
A policy that was entirely unsupported by evidence.
Completely. A systematic review of this policy change found that eliminating recess had no measurable negative effects on academic achievement. However, it led to observable negative consequences for student behavior and attention in the classroom.
So it was an unnecessary removal of necessary developmental time.
It was based on an economic efficiency model that completely ignored the crucial non-cognitive function of play.
This deep dive has been an intense journey. We've gone from the microscopic precision of neurobiology all the way to the skepticism introduced by these large-scale replication failures. But I think we have established a clear path forward for anyone focused on creating optimal learning environments.
Let's try to consolidate the key takeaways. First, the Goldilocks solution is empirically validated. Guided play is optimal. Child-led activity with adult scaffolding consistently outperforms both pure free play and direct instruction for targeted outcomes. You get substantial gains, like that G equals 0.93 advantage for spatial vocabulary.
Second, and this might be the most profound insight for policymakers and for parents, is the asymmetry. deprivation outweighs enrichment. The harm caused by removing adequate autonomous play is neurologically measurable, and it's far larger than the measurable benefit you get from simply optimizing or adding extra play. The focus has to be on protecting that minimum effective dose.
And third, we have clear, actionable metrics tied directly to physical mechanisms, dose inequity. Play sessions have to be sustained for at least 35 minutes to yield those chronic, measurable executive function gains. And these interventions are most effective, with that huge effect size of G equals 0.785 for children, starting with the greatest disadvantages. That makes play a powerful engine for educational equity and opportunity.
So if we accept all these nuances, the strong neurobiological mechanism, the surprisingly modest population-level effect sizes, the success of guided play, and this pervasive problem of equifinality, it leaves us with one central, unresolved question to really mull over.
And the question is this. If play is merely one of multiple possible routes, equifinality to positive development, and other structured or directed activities could theoretically achieve similar EF gains, should we be focusing less on mandating how children play, you know, trying to control the pedagogical style.
And more on.
And more on ensuring they have the structural and systemic conditions, the protected time, the genuine autonomy, and the supportive environments that allow development to proceed effectively through whatever pathway the child chooses for themselves.
So if the outcome matters more than the specific path, the focus shifts radically from curriculum design to systemic support for the child's independent development. A fascinating challenge to end on.
Find full research and sources at research.yuda.me. That's Yuda.mene.
Thank you for joining the Deep Dive.